Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Well, in this hour, we'll be bringing you a recorded interview, a conversation with novelist Peter Orner. He was visiting the campus back in April as part of the Carr Writers Series. This is something that's sponsored by the university's creative writing program. Periodically, they bring in authors, and I've had a chance to talk with many. It's always been a good experience. So we did that, even though we couldn't do it live on the air. We did it here in the studio. This was on April 19th. So as you listen in this hour, Focus 580, just keep in mind that for today, this hour will not be taking calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with Peter Orner. He's a writer who's here visiting the University of Illinois. He's here as part of the university's creative writing program. This is the Carr Visiting Author Series for spring 2007. We've been lucky enough in the past to talk with a number of writers, poets, who've been here to read from their work and talk about their work with students who are wanting to be writers themselves. And we're very pleased that he could be here. We'll talk a little bit about his life, his experiences, his work, being a teacher. He was born in Chicago. He's author of the novel The Second Coming of Mavala Shikongo, published by Little Brown in 2006, and also a story collection, Esther Stories, that was published by Houghton Mifflin in 2001. His book is a San Francisco Chronicle bestseller. It won the Bard Fiction Prize. His book, Esther Stories, was awarded the Rome Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, also the Goldberg Prize for Jewish Fiction, and was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award. It's also published in the Atlantic Monthly, the Paris Review, McSweeney's, the Southern Review, and other publications. And he teaches at San Francisco State University in the graduate writing program there. And we're very pleased that he could be here on this program to talk with us. Just for the benefit of people listening, this is a recorded interview. So this morning in this part of the show, we are not taking phone calls as we usually would. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. There's a lot that I would like to talk about your writing and something about your experiences. Mm-hmm. Was there a particular time that you can think of when you knew that being a writer and writing was going to be a big part of your life?
It's an interesting question. I didn't talk much as a kid. You know, I was pretty mm-hmm. quiet, and I grew up in a family of pretty boisterous storytellers, and my brother in particular. And I think that I learned early on that I was more the listener in the family than the talker, and I think I stored up a lot of things that I later came out when I started to actually have my own voice and speak. And so I learned storytelling sort of at the hands of these master storytellers in my family, and then I tried to emulate it on the page.
Yeah. Your writing style, I think, is unusual. At least I'm not sure that I have seen somebody else whose approach to prose was quite like yours.
Well, thank you. I hope.
And no, well, I think it's, well, first of all, I guess yeah. I would say that the voices seems to me to be unique. And I don't know, perhaps conversational is the way that I would describe it, as if someone was telling you the story, mm-hmm. because it has a it has sort of an odd mix of long sentences and short, some that I guess, if you know, I would expect one's English teacher to say, no, sentence fragments, sorry, right. No, you can't do that.
A lot of fragments.
But that is, in fact, the way that people talk,
sure.
and that it does sound like it's a story that is being told to you by someone. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we should, at this point, I'll have you read something, and
sure.
we can introduce people to the writing, and then we can go back and talk a little bit more about
okay.
it.
Okay, great. I'm going to read a little bit from this novel called The Second Coming of Mavala Shikongo, which came out in April. And the book, I just should set it up a bit. Mm-hmm. It's the book is set in Namibia, in southern Africa, soon after Namibia's independence in 1990. And the book is set at a small farm school in the middle of the veld, which is about 40 kilometers from any town. And it's very, very isolated. And the book is told from different voices. And the sort of reigning principle of the book, and the quote that I use to open the book, is, "We cannot speak with one voice as we are scattered." And I'm going to read from the voice of Obadiah Horiseb, who's a third grade teacher at this farm school. Namibia has a pretty violent history, and at this point in Namibia's history, the war was over and independence happened. And so one of the issues I try to deal with in the book is how people deal with getting what you want. When independence occurs, then what? And Obadiah is sort of a restless character. He's an insomniac. And he's been teaching third grade for 35 years. And he's up. This is 3 in the morning. It's called Goas Morning. Goas is the name of the farm. It's not yet morning, and Obadiah sits in the paling darkness in his blue chair and caresses his new Grundig radio. The batteries are spent, and the generator's been off for hours, but still he imagines what it might tell him or what song it might play, because there's so much going on now, even all the way out here in this silent little box. A cacophony of unheard voices, and here Obadiah sits in a robe and slippers, listening to possibility. Astonishing, isn't it, that there is ever silence in a world so vast and full of voices? Today, in class, he'll yank out all the great maps from the locked cabinet and tack them up all over the walls, show the children the North Pole, Siberia, Alaska, the Philippines, Addis Ababa, Cairo, Montevideo. He'll thrill the children with the possibilities of maps. The world sits flat and conquerable. All pilgrimages are possible. Maps, his heart soars. Is there anything so glorious as a map? Even for a man who rarely ventures farther than the pick and pay in Caribbean. His wife, Governor General of the farm, Antoinette, sleeps. And in the darkness, he sees her without needing to look towards the half-open bedroom door. Antoinette sleeps with her feet sticking out from under the blankets like two paddles she'd smack him with. Her mouth gripped tight. She sleeps with her teeth clenched in case she should die. Her soul might escape, she says. She breathes, noisy, out of her nose. And when they were younger, he used to kiss her as she slept. He'd pry open her mouth with his tongue. Was that myself? I'd like to do it now. Why can't I? He lets go of the radio but remains where he is, looking at nothing and everything. The newspaper, photographs thumbtacked to the wall behind his head, Bobby Kennedy, Miriam Makeva, a handcuffed Zephania Kamita, clerical collar and still the man held a gun and fought in a bush war. They all stare at him, waiting for him to do something. Do what? What would you gallants on the wall have me do? He'd like a nip. Half pint of Zorba's in his closet, waiting for him in a worn-out loafer, its copper top peeping out like a baby's head. And in the hostel, the boys are sleeping. In Windhoek, his sons, Thomas and Maddie, both employed, are sleeping. In Tehran, two lovers, Tehranians, sleep. In Moscow, old cosmonauts gracefully sleep. In Peru, Morocco, Flanders. Why can't I sleep? The windmill behind the mission garage begins to move, one hesitant creech, then another, until it reaches full squeal. And he sees it, looming above the mission garage in the dark. Air motor, Chicago. Another place I'd like to go. Bismarck himself, that old colonial mustache, said, if I could only see Chicago. On the other side of the blue chair is Antoinette's unfinished needlework. He wants to touch it. He wants to touch whatever it is she's making now, to twist his fingers in that scrumble of yarn. But he doesn't move, doesn't reach for it. He only thinks about what it would feel like if he did, which is different, isn't it? He wants only to want. And he listens to her gusty breathing in the bedroom as the light turns from fog to yellow. Antoinette's roosters crow all night. They never sleep either. To them, it's always dawn. Even so, Obadiah thinks, isn't there always a darkening before morning? Why not touch? Why not go to her right now, my Antoinette? Why are there times, he's thought this before, 1,000 times before, we'd rather want than grasp?
Peter Orner reading from his novel, The Second Coming of Mavla Chikango. It was published in 2006. The way that you write, it's in a sense, it's a collection of vignettes mm-hmm. that are linked, obviously, by place, by the fact that the characters are related and so forth. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stories in the story collection are, in a sense, like that, too. They're short stories, and some of them are extraordinarily short. Sure. They're very short, just like little snapshots. Yeah. And, you know, in the way that you do that, you approach storytelling, makes me wonder if you had ever written poetry. There's something that that's in this approach, the economy of language, this kind of presenting discrete but powerful images, that makes me think, well, that's really what you're trying to do with poetry.
Sure, I would never. I don't think I've ever written a poem. I mean, you know, that I would confess publicly, because to me it's almost the highest form of writing, and you know, I think poetry has a lot to teach prose, because I think what poetry can do in few words is what I think some prose writers like myself try and accomplish. It's not, you know, it's a aesthetic that I don't know where I even got, because some of my favorite novels are long tomes, like Bleak House and Moby Dick are two of my favorite books. But even those have short chapters. And so I noticed from books like that where you can build a book in brief moments and keep building and building and building. And for me, that's sort of the way life is. Like, it doesn't happen to me. I don't see life linearly as a plot. I see it sort of as a series of insane moments that I try and get out of, or something like that. You know, I think in building a book, especially a book that's set in a farm in Namibia where frankly not much happens, and the days sort of rise and fall, I tried to capture this idea of that, you know, we sort of existed out there. And I lived in Namibia for almost 2 years, and it became part of me, this sort of the way that the days would seem the same, but they seem different because of the stories we would tell each other, my colleagues, these other teachers on this farm. So I tried to replicate that.
Let me just quickly introduce, for anybody who might have tuned in, our guest for this hour, Peter Orner. He teaches in the graduate writing program at San Francisco State University. He's here visiting the campus as part of the Carr Writers Series, the Carr Visiting Authors Series. It's sponsored by the Creative Writing Program here at the University of Illinois. He is the author of the novel The Second Coming of Mavla Shikongo, and also and also the story collection Esther Stories. And he's here to talk about his writing, to talk with students, and we're really pleased to have him here to talk with us. As you explained, the novel is set in Namibia, and that it's at least in part inspired by, informed by your own experiences having lived there for a year and a half, 2 years. Right. How did you happen to go to Namibia?
During college, I was a bad journalist. I'm a failed journalist. And one of the things I did while I was failing at journalism was I covered the divestment movement at the University of Michigan. And I'm sure it was fairly large here at University of Illinois, too. Students were protesting the university's investment in South Africa. And they built shanties on the Diag at Michigan and lived in them. And it was a fairly prominent student movement in the late 80s. And so I became very interested in South African politics. And when I graduated, I was sort of trolling around, and I really wanted to go to Southern Africa. And you couldn't really go to South Africa at that time because it was still under apartheid government. So Namibia became independent in 90, and I thought, well, I'll get close. I'll see this part of Africa up close, because Namibia had essentially been a colony of South Africa, and so I wanted to see what it was like to be in a newly independent nation.
Hmm. There is a character in the book named Larry Kaplansky. This is an American
right.
who decides that he's going to
a hapless American
decides he's going to go to Namibia because he wants to do something. He wants to teach.
Sure.
So he shows up at this place.
Right.
And that I'm sure that a lot of people, just knowing what you could read about you on a dust jacket, would say, well, this must be you. Are you in what way is the character of Larry you?
It's funny. It's a good question. And when you write fiction, you know, you start out thinking you're writing about yourself. And then, you know, I write a little bit of nonfiction, but not much, because I'm not very good at it, because I'm never good at actually telling things straight. So even when, you know, Kaplansky has sort of my demographic, he's a white Jewish guy from the Midwest. I claim those things. But as I was, the book was sort of based on memories from 16 years ago, and I wrote the book over kind of an 11-year period, and it was based on memories, but then I would twist them, as any fiction writer does, and so it became less and less me every day. And in some ways, the Obadiah piece that I just read, he's almost more me. I'm an insomniac, and I read a lot of history at night. So I almost identify more with a 65-year-old Namibian third-grade teacher than I do with the person that's supposed to be me. So it's all twisted around.
Well, I suppose that is the beauty of creating characters. You can, in as much as everybody has different aspects to their personality, you could create characters that are all you in some way.
Sure, yeah, exactly. And I think that's sort of the beauty and what I love my job, because, you know, I can do this. I can sort of, and then I can put people in, other people who aren't supposed to be there. My grandfather appears in this book in various ways. And so, you know, I'm constantly playing with character's really, really important to me as a writer. And sort of that's, and I like to mix and match. And because I think people, you know, people are constantly coming up with new notions of themselves in a way. And, you know, so we're constantly inventing, even if we're not writing fiction, right?
Well, I suppose one of the challenges, I'm sure, in creating character is creating characters that feel real. Because if I assume that if that doesn't happen, then readers aren't going to feel invested in the characters. Right. And at some point, they're just going to say, I don't care what happens to the people. What you want is for them to care. So for that reason, I'm sure that part of it is characters that feel, that act like real people, that talk like real people, and you say, yes, I believe that this is, I believe that this, when I close the book, I believe that this person lives.
Right.
How do you do that?
I think that's the billion-dollar question, and who knows who does it. You know, I try every day to do it, but it's, you know, I think it's the hardest thing, because you want, I mean, when I read a book and I love a book, it's because those people are real, and I close the book and I miss them, and I think I did the best I could to write a book, and it's why it took me so long, because I didn't want to leave them. I didn't ever want to close them away. I'm still writing stories. I'm still writing this book even after it's already published, because I miss them and they're still talking to me, which is kind of nice that I didn't quite have to give them up. So I think it's a hard thing, because sometimes people read for different reasons, but I read to get to know other people, and that's sort of what I pride most, or what I try to do the most.
Well, I someone said, now I don't remember who it was, but I all remembered it, that they read because in their life they can only really meet so many people.
Right.
And that what reading does is that it gives you an opportunity to, in a sense, to meet far more people than you ever actually will meet in your life.
Yeah, and you can sort of have them for yourself in a way. It's a weird sort of... Anne Tyler said something like she writes because she wants to live more than one life. And I think that's a similar idea.
Yeah. I read that, and as you said, that you spent a long time writing this novel.
In
the meanwhile, as you were working on that, you also wrote the stories that are in the story collection.
Right.
And I think that I also read you said something that when you started out to write the novel, you really didn't know what you were doing, or what it was going to be, or how it was going to be structured. And I'm sure that most writers, as they train, what you do first is you write stories. You deal with a somewhat shorter form. So I don't know how you approach the idea of writing a much bigger story, unless one way you do it is to think about how can I break this down into smaller pieces and think about it that way.
It's a I think. I mean, one thing I will say is stories are, everything is hard. So to me, writing, I mean, I love stories, and I think we need more readers of stories in this world. And, you know, you hear all these horror stories about, you know, publishers not wanting to publish short story collections, and I think that's very sad. But I also think that you know, to me, when I approached the novel, there was one sort of thing that I kept remembering, and that is, well, they kept bubbling back, is that I didn't want to leave these people, and that so the days grew, and the book sort of evolved simply because I kept watching them and spending more time with them, and obviously things start to happen. There's love stories, and there's a lot of sadness in this book, and a lot of things that are unfortunate, but there's also a lot of humorous you know, you get through the day laughing in a way. And when I was remembering my experience in Namibia, I remembered that, you know, it was a hard life, and it was much harder for the Namibians I knew than for me. I mean, I was there temporarily. But I, what I realized is we sort of collectively got through the day by telling stories. And some of these stories would extend over the course of weeks. Some of them would end right then. And so I tried to create a book that tried to emulate that idea. And I also came across once a Mozambican writer who said that we don't have, he himself didn't have the same concept of a novel as Europeans did. And that helped me immensely because I thought, all right, I can tell a story and I can tell a longer story and it need not follow certain conventions, and yet it can be a novelistic story. Mm-hmm. It can be long enough for people to stay with and stay in this world. So I tried.
You talked a little bit about the setting for the story being this kind of remote, sort of dusty farm mm-hmm. village
right.
where there's this little Catholic boys' school.
Right.
It's all boys.
Right.
And all the faculty, I think all the faculty are men
right.
in the school.
Most of them, yeah.
Most of them.
Yeah.
And so here we have this place where the guys are spending an awful lot of time thinking about the absence of female companionship and
right.
what they'd do if they had the right. opportunity. And into this comes the title character, a
right.
woman who had lived in the village, had gone off and been a freedom fighter, mm-hmm. and then now had come back
right.
And was the object of a lot of attention and
right.
desire. Did you intentionally go into this somehow thinking that, you know, unfulfilled longing was going to be an important theme?
I think unfulfilled longing is, you said it, you know, right there. I think all my work and a lot of writers that I admire very much, that seems to be something you live with. And I think what I was allowed to do on this isolated farm was just to sort of exploit that idea to larger proportions. And Mavala, when Mavala, I mean, she has what a lot of the men at the school want. She was a soldier, mm-hmm. and she fought. And just a bit, a little background, because Namibia's history isn't known to everybody. Namibia fought a long war against the South African military on the border between Namibia and Angola. And I met, when I was in Namibia, a lot of people who did fight in that conflict, whites and blacks, against each other. And I met women, and women did, in fact, fight in this conflict. And so Mavala as a character was based on some of the people that I knew. And the question was, I think, after independence, what were women going to do? Because it's a pretty patriarchal place, you know? And so people like Mavala who fought, then independence happens and things sort of get back to normal. And she, women like her, that I knew, didn't necessarily have a place. So what did they do? They taught. And teaching is actually a very noble profession in Namibia, as it should be elsewhere, and needs more respect in general. But she taught, but she wasn't necessarily suited to be a teacher, but that was the profession that was open to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she, I don't want to give away too much of the story here,
sure.
but essentially she begins an affair with Larry.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The outsider.
Mm-hmm. Right. Larry and Mavala have some things in common, not too much. They're both very, very young. They're both in their early 20s, and they're both casting around for what to do with their lives, and they're thrown together, as often happens in a situation like this. And, you know, something happens, blooms between them, I suppose, in a way, in the desert, and they... But it's such a small place, and everybody knows each other. So this affair has to happen in deep secrecy. It's a Catholic school, and there's rules against fraternization between the women, the very few women on the farm, and the men. And so they have to do this in a very secretive manner.
Mm-hmm. But can there be any in a place like this? It's your classic small town.
Sure,
can
yeah.
there really be any secrets?
not quite. And in some ways, in one of the you know, the reigning jokes of the book is that the two of them really think it's a secret, but everybody certainly knows. And they sort of, like I think some people do in love, they have this complete blinders on about the rest of the universe, and they don't realize that it's so obvious. And so they get made fun of by other characters in the book because they're in secret and nobody, they're only in secret to themselves. And that kind of works. And it's more exciting to be in a secret affair than to be in one that's outward. Marvel also has a child, and she, you know, out of wedlock child, and that doesn't help matters in this particular pretty conservative place.
Yeah. Just quickly again to introduce our guest, Peter Orner. He teaches in the graduate writing program at San Francisco State University. He has written the novel The Second Coming of Mavla Shikongo. It's published by Little Brown 2006, and also a story collection, Esther Stories, published by Houghton Mifflin 2001. He's also published fiction in The Atlantic Monthly and The Paris Review, McSweeney's, The Southern Review, and other places. He's won a number of awards for his work. He's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, sponsored by the university's Creative Writing Program. This is the Carr Visiting Author Series for spring 2007, and over the last couple of years, we've been fortunate enough to have a number of writers, poets on this program to talk about their work, and we're pleased that he's here. There's a recorded interview, however, today. That means we're not taking calls. After you came back, this and here's another aspect of your life that sure. I think is interesting and sort of different. After you came back from the time that you were in Namibia, you went to law school, right? Yeah. And did complete law school and have done some work as a lawyer, I understand, as a public defender, and continued to do some kind of work that involves human rights kind of work. How did was it your intention when you came back from Namibia to go to law school right at that point?
I come from a very legal family, and actually my family warned me off law school, but I went in spite of them. There was no pressure. Sometimes people ask me, well, did your family convince you?
And they said it was all my own mistake.
But seriously, I went to a law school called Northeastern in Boston, and it's sort of a law school, and maybe there's some Northeastern listeners out there. It's sort of a law school in part for rabble-rousers, you know, they teach you the basics of law, but they also teach you how to fight the system in certain ways. And so I actually enjoyed my experience there because I was surrounded by people who have gone on to do amazing things in the law, and I respect them very much. But politics is very interesting to me. In the book, I talk about the new government of Namibia and the new legal system they're setting up, and I'm fascinated by that. And I think law is actually intrinsically a part of the stories we tell. And so I think I actually learned, you know, a lot in law school. I wouldn't recommend it as a place to go to learn how to write, but in some ways I did a lot. I remember sitting at the back of, like, trust and estates class, and I was writing stories because trust and estates, they're fighting over wills. They're fighting over, you know, so you've got families in there, and it's all right there on the page and people's names and who hates who and why. And so I got a lot out of that kind of stories. And law really is about stories. So I think that it helped me in ways. And although I don't do it as much now because I think to be a lawyer, as you lawyers out there know, it's a full-time commitment, and I couldn't write novels if I did it. But I do some stuff on the side, and particularly asylum cases, where I take a case and I bring a case to the immigration court, and I argue in favor of asylum for a particular person.
Would you like to read a little bit of something else? I don't know if you'd want to read something again from the novel or something from the story collection. You may do whatever you like. I would just like to give people a chance to hear just a little bit more of the book and what it sounds like. And I always think it's interesting to hear writers in their own voices read their work. I know he is now madly paging for the
right.
Because he had not prepared for I did not tip him off, and he did not prepare for this, so he's thinking, okay, what am I going to do? This guy said I want to read something.
I'll try this. Okay. Namibia is a very dry place. It has it's got the oldest desert in the world, they say, Namib. I don't know how they calculate such things. And the Kalahari, too. So Namibia is extremely dry. In most of the parts of Namibia, in northern Namibia, it's considerably more tropical climate. But the place that I lived was fairly in the center of the country, and rain was obviously extremely rare. and important, and when it happened, it was a pretty big deal. So I'll read a section about rain.
Great.
Rain, those few times it came without thunder. You could feel something bloated about the air when you breathed, and you knew. And you also knew that it would disappear as quickly as it arrived, that by tomorrow the dark stain in the sand would be as gone as the silence of the rain itself. I learned at least this, that the rain carried its own engulfing silence, and that it too would leave us, as if none of it ever happened. And then the Erongo Mountains would emerge from the clouds and loom again, and the relentless sun would pierce our thin walls, and we'd curse the rain for bothering us in the first place. It had been a glorious downpour, but it had gone on for nearly 3 hours, and it was no longer a miracle, and however fleeting and teasing, it always started as a miracle. Now it was just rain again. We were waiting for after rain, when the sun would rise, battered, like a wet loaf. When Antoinette's chickens would shake out their dirty feathers and saunter again. When the younger boys would start whittling sticks to spear the fantasy fish the older boys lied to them about. Don't you know? They swim down from Avambaland when the heavy rains come. Those boys, lying on their stomach, watching the amazing river of actual water, looking for barbel or pink-bellied scroot. But the only thing that the momentarily flowing Kuseb carried along was a few drowned mice. The earth slogged, the water curled in our footprints in the sand, all of it mud now. We'd all retreated to our rooms when Pohamba knocked on the wall and shouted, "Mother Goas has birthed another lunatic." Then he came to my door and ordered, "Come and see." In wet feet, towels over our heads, we went out to the edge of the soccer field, and there was Dikalidi at midfield, whirling. The rain was still falling in gray veils. Festus was out there too, on his back, playing his fatty chest like bongos. And Dikalidi was wearing his stupid straw hat and laughing, her arms stretched out, her wet breasts swinging as if they were trying to reach out to her hands. Rain-worn, we craved her more. Pohamba kicked his door and yowled about his toe. I rammed my door also. And for once our envy of teacher Festus and his wife spoke with one voice. It was too much. We shut up our windows and listened to the silence of our rooms, of our lonely beds, as the dread rain pounded our corrugated roofs.
Yeah, and this woman is one of the few women on the scene, and so this wet T-shirt moment lived long in the imaginations of the men.
It certainly did, much to their chagrin and shame in a way. Mm-hmm. But it's an image, and Festus is the lucky guy with Dikalidi.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that this book does is. And it does it in a somewhat indirect way that I don't quite understand, but I think that it really does convey a good sense of the place without you spending a lot of time doing deliberate description.
Sure.
And I'm sure that people have read books where an author goes to great length to describe some place to the point where you say, okay, enough of that. I get it. And yet, and in other writers, somehow they manage to convey the sense of place in a more mysterious way. You don't know how it happened. You just know that it happened.
Well, it's very kind of you in this context. I really appreciate it. I think that one of the things that sometimes bothers me about certain books is that they, especially some of the books I'd read that were set in Africa, that they were always trying to prove something so much. And I think, mm-hmm. If you're writing about a place you know, I try anyway to just make it your own and do your best you can, but you don't need to... Once somebody tries to convince, I think there's the danger. So I do try and do that, and with limited degrees of success sometimes. But I try not to lay it on too thick, or else I know I'll lose my sense of place. If you were to write about the place you know most, you probably wouldn't describe it in great minutia. You'd probably go for what really rises, and so that's what I try and do.
And
not that minutia is bad. I like minutia too.
You did. In addition to this being the product of that time that you that initial time that you lived there, you did do research, read about Namibia, actually went back, spent some more time.
Right.
So there was, it sounds as if there was a considerable amount of research and prep that lay behind the writing that you ended up with in the book.
I think that's the other part of this, is you end up knowing a lot more than, at least I tried to know more than actually put in. And Namibia is a fascinating place and has a fascinating history, and one that needs to be written about more and known about more in this country and around the world. It's twice colonized, which is fairly rare, by the Germans and the South Africans, and has a whole rich history that I loved. But you know, when I was writing a novel, you realize that it you can't tell everything. And the book was almost half longer in its original form, so there were there's probably 75 more pages. But what I found was that I was bogging down my characters with my own knowledge of Namibia. And I think you have to lay off, I think, when you're doing fiction, I think, in order to let your characters talk and not you and your encyclopedic knowledge of Namibian history, at least in my case.
Yeah. So one of the things I read about you is you do a lot of rewriting.
I do a lot of rewriting. Obsessively. I wish I could stop. God. You know, I envy those writers who just, it is what it is. First look, best look, or something.
I mean, you get to the book, you have something, and you think, no, that's not good.
I do it now.
And you look at it again and say, no.
Yeah, I wish I could stop. It's hard. You know, but you kind of always want to be better, and you know you can't be, and you just chase it. And I think sometimes it is good to not do that. I'm just an obsessive nature of mine. I sometimes wish I could go forward. When I'm not writing something, I go back and I rewrite something else. It's just as a way of working, you know, because I always need to feel like I'm working. You know, it's a hard job. It's unquantifiable sometimes. You know, we don't get paid by the hour or whatever. So, you know.
Well, and I know that there's some writers who talk about the fact that they have to do it almost as if they were going to the office.
Right.
They say, okay,
right.
I'm going to get up at a certain time. I'm going to put a tie on. I'm going to go to the place where I write. I'm going to sit there, and I'm going to sit there for a fixed amount of time. Even if I don't put anything down on there in the page, I'm going to do that, and that they have to, in a sense, force themselves to do it, or else they wouldn't do it at all.
Right. And I think a lot of writers beat themselves up. I don't write enough, you know, and writers out there probably know this, you know. And I think I always tell people in it, because I try and tell this to myself, is take it easy. And just, you know, I think stories sometimes can't be forced. And I think that if you just sort of lay off, and this is against my obsessive rewriting, because I need to tell this to myself, just let your people talk and get out of the way. And I interfere a lot in them, and I think I'd like to do that less. So, but I think that's a good, you know, just kind of, it is a job, you know, it's a job I love, but it's also, I can justify, I can walk around, I can talk to you. I mean, it's like I can get ideas constantly, and I don't always have to, like, be actually scribbling. I think, you know, I think there's a lot of writing in the world. Now with blogging, there's even more. Yeah. I mean, you know, so I say take it easy.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly more outlets for people who want to, whether anybody wants to read what
in
they write,
way.
That's something else.
Right.
You know, but there's ways to get it out.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Our guest, Peter Orner, he is a writer. He teaches in the graduate writing program at San Francisco State University, has written the novel that he's read from, The Second Coming of Mavla Shikongo, also a collection of stories, Esther stories. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, taking part in the CAR Visiting Authors series, and we're pleased to have him here on the program. And this is, let me again say, for people listening, it is a recorded interview. We are not taking calls as we usually do. I also read, I thought this was interesting, that you write by hand. You don't use a word processor?
I write by hand initially. I write by hand and then I transfer it eventually. But I've always done this. I don't know why.
I think if I was, well, I write, you know, I do a lot of note taking to get ready to do things like this. And I do the same thing. I don't, in my house, I don't have a computer.
Wow. You're,
so, you're good. I don't know. People could, I guess, accuse me of being old fashioned. But, and I think that if I were going to write something, that's what I would do too. And I'm not exactly sure why. Something about it, and maybe it's that it almost forces you to slow down and be a little bit more deliberate somehow? I don't know.
I mean, I think in that case, I think it's true. And I'm not one of those people who's like, you must write by hand, you know, as if it's somehow like a religious thing or something. But it's just, for me, it allows me, it does. I do write very slow. And, you know, writing emails, you know how fast you go. And I do that. And so I think, you know, there's just a difference. But it's me. And this is not for everybody. And it's not, but it's something that I've always just, since a kid, I've always... My brother was an artist, and I just would watch him hold pens, and I think that's where it came from. And I love that contact. And I'm always looking for a new notebook, and I'm sort of weird about this. I just like that a lot.
Yeah.
So, but W.H. Auden said something like, you know, you write by hand and you fall in love with your language, and that's bad. So, you know, and Calvino said the computer is amazing, and we should do this and embrace the technology. And so, you know, I think there's all sorts of ways of writing a good story, not just... this one.
Yeah.
So.
Your brother, he does graphic novels?
He does.
Is that
right? Yeah, the mostly Unfabulous Social Life of Ethan Green. It's also a film. They made a film out of it.
I know that I read something about it and about him. Has that any attraction ever for you to being involved in the visual arts? Or you just say, no. So now I got enough.
Leave that to him. He actually did there's a map in the book of Namibia, and my brother Eric drew that, and it was very kind of him. It's not something I grew up watching him, and just, you know how you just can't do it. You just can't do something. And so I think maybe stories came out of my desire to do something like that, you know, maybe it was what I could do. So,
I'm interested in having you talk about teaching writing, and I guess I'm, you know, whenever I talk to somebody who does it, in addition to being a writer, also works with students, I applaud that, and I'm sure that it's very challenging, and I guess the thing that I think about is if you're working with someone, they've written something, and you're sitting down and you're looking at it, and you're trying to suggest what they might do with it. Maybe they don't know, or they have some idea, or you think that it could be improved in some ways. I would think that one of the first impulses might be to rewrite it as if you would have written it in the first place.
Right.
So the difficult thing would be to try to help them write it in the best way for them, the best way that they possibly can, without interfering and getting in there and saying, and at some level doing, well, you know, if I was doing this, I would do it completely. Obviously, that's not what you want to do.
You said it. I mean, that's it. You know, like you say, you know, you don't, you know, I have mixed feelings about the idea of teaching writing in general. And in fact, I think although I officially do, it's more about stories and literature and sort of the connections between and sort of growing and reading. And I'm much more interested in that than I am in, because sometimes when you critique a story, you know, it's inevitable that you'd want to make it and what I love about reading is it's not me, you know, it's not me, and I'm not going to rewrite anybody else when I pick up a book. But there's something about having a manuscript there that there's a temptation, I think, on the part of, you know, some people, I think, to try and rewrite in their own image. And, you know, I do my best to encourage writers, because I don't think of them as students, they're writers, and I think of them as just, you know, you got to find your own voice and work with that. And I was very lucky. I had a mentor and very close friend, Andre Debuse, who is one of our great short story writers. His son is a wonderful novelist as well, Andre Debuse III. But Andre would listen to I'd go to his house on Thursday nights, and we'd read our stories to him. And he'd sit back in his wheelchair, and he would listen as a reader, as a listener, and I think I've tried in my own, you know, teaching to emulate Andre, which was, you know, he was extremely interested in what writers had to say, and I was a punk just back from Africa working on this book. This was many years ago, and so I've tried to do that and not impose. Imposing, I think, is a danger, because, you know, no writer worth anything listens too much to the opinions of other people when it comes to their own work. You know, and they should listen a little, and then mostly not listen, I think.
Yeah. Is the part of the idea that that they have something to say, and that you get it? I mean, is it partly that you're saying to them was something like, well, I think I understand the story that you're trying to tell here, but that somehow it's not clear or it's not coming through, or not so much change this word or take this paragraph and move it up here, but it's, you know, I don't know, maybe it's removing clutter. It's taking things that are unnecessary. It's saying, well, somehow this doesn't make sense. I'm sure that it's different with every person that you would be working
and
with.
I think, I mean, but you're exactly right. I mean, you float around and, you know, almost like being a doctor, you're looking around for a diagnosis. And that's, and like I said, that's sometimes a problem because, you know, storytelling is, you know, comes from a lot of different places, and it's, you know, oral, you know, I come from a background of listening to stories and oral storytelling, and I'm very interested in that. And I think when you have a good storyteller who's telling you a story, you're not going to interrupt them and critique them about their transition. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes as readers, especially as a, you know, in my role as a teacher, I try and have the most open mind and try and understand why people are telling a story in that way. There must be a reason. And you know, sometimes they're just bad and you can't do anything about it. And you just say, hey, try it again. Try telling something again. And you could tell, you know, I'm meeting with students from University of Illinois program in a little bit. And I read the stories, and they're wonderful. And they have unique voices, two very distinct stories. Wonderful. And, you know, and if I was writing them, of course I'd write them differently, but that's the beauty of it. I'm not. So, you know, but you know, it's actually wonderful in a lot of ways because you meet and talk to people who are interested in stories and literature. And that, I think, is the great advantage of a writing class, for example.
Yeah. Do you talked about the fact that when you were working before, that you and the other people who were writing, when you got together with your mentor, that people would read the stories to him.
Yeah.
Do in your writing, is that something that at some point you read the thing?
I read to myself. I wander around the house and I read it to myself, and I do. You know, I try and hear it. Sometimes I used to tape record. That didn't quite work. But you know, I like the story about Obadiah. You know, when he's sitting, I read that story to myself 100 times just to try and just, you know, can I hear this? Is it 3 a.m? Is Obadiah talking to himself? And I think it's important to hear it. You know, in my own head. And you know, reading is different than hearing. But I think they are intrinsically connected. A good book, you will start to hear it, I think, as you read.
So what are you working on now?
Something
a significant big... Oh, well, if you don't want to talk about that,
I
understand that.
I
understand
you know, it's always... I'm always working, and you know, I never quite know. And it's, you kind of work in the dark, you know, and I... Like this said, this book took me so long, and then one day I realized, this may be a book. You know, it shocked me, actually. And so I'm working now, actually, again with history. I'm doing a lot of research, and this book is set closer to home. My family's from Massachusetts originally, but I grew up in the Chicago area. So I'm interested I'm looking at family history from both angles, from my Massachusetts side and my Chicago side, and I'm looking into that. It's been fun.
Yeah. Who, you know, I'm mystified on the one hand by the what we're told that there are so few readers and nobody's reading. And then I go to the bookstore and I think, well, there's plenty of books here, and I see people in here.
somebody
must be going on. Yeah. Who is your ideal reader? Who are you writing for, do you think?
That's such a great question. I get, you know, such a good question. I think, you know, people who want and are interested in other people, and I hate to say this, but I think that, and this is a cheap shot and probably not true, but I'll say it anyway. You know, the popularity of memoirs and the popularity of people writing them, and again, this is nothing against my close friends who write them and write important books that are. But I think that there is this obsession almost with, like, the self. And I think the reason that I read is, like you said earlier, to get to know other people. Mm-hmm. And I find that my ideal reader would be somebody who is interested in broadening their scope of who they know and who they want to spend time with, and that, you know, and I find that for some reason that I think that's going away a little bit. I don't know why that is. If we had callers, we could ask, you know, yeah. but I don't know. Why do you think?
Well, I don't know. I guess at one point I certainly have been mystified by the immense popularity of the confessional memoir.
Sure,
and I don't. That's not what I want to read, and I guess right. I'm not really exactly sure
you're
why anybody would. Well, I don't know. I guess though I do, as a form of recreation, I do read a lot of fiction. Mm-hmm. Sometimes literary, sometimes not. I guess mostly, you know, what I'm looking for is to be taken out of my
right.
self and
right.
my life.
Right.
You know, I'd say to somebody, I'd say, tell me a good story that takes place someplace completely different, far away. I don't want to be here. I want to be someplace else. And somebody who can do that, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be high art. Somebody who can do that for me, then that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that that's, I mean, it's just critical. I think there are people, there's going to be people forever who, and this is what I hear when, you know, nobody reads stories anymore. But it's, you know, there's stories being read and written all the time, thank God. And they will be forever, regardless of you know, what the publishers say. Yeah. So I think, you know, it is shrinking, and there's, you know, evidence for this, hard evidence, I suppose. But there's also evidence that more books are being published now than ever before. So, you know, I think the book isn't quite dead yet.
Yeah. Well, there we'll have to finish. We're done. Our guest, Peter Orner, teaches at San Francisco State University. Look for his books, the novel The Second Coming of Mavla Shikongo and the story collection, Esther's Stories. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.